Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. A recent act of police brutality sparked protests that started in Minneapolis and spread across the country. How can we promote racial healing in our country? Our guest today has a unique view on racial reconciliation. J. Chester Johnson is the author of Damaged Heritage, The Elaine Race Massacre and a Story of Reconciliation, a book that illuminates a critical but largely unknown piece of American history. The Elaine Massacre claimed between 100 and perhaps hundreds of African Americans in southeastern Arkansas just over a century ago. Our guest, Chester Johnson, is directly connected to one of the people responsible for that violence. His book maps out both the causes of racism as well as the reason it persists. Most importantly, he provides a living illustration of how the division between Black and white might be healed. Chester Johnson, welcome to All Together Now.
Well, thank you, Eleanor, for having me here.
Well, you have a fascinating story and an amazing book, and I am so eager to share it with our listeners, particularly at this time in our country where the issue of race is really up big time.
Right.
So first, what inspired you to write your book, Damaged Heritage?
Well, there are several facets to that, to the answer. I had in 2008, I wrote the Litany of Offense and Apology for the Episcopal Church when it, for its National Day of Repentance, when it formally apologized for its role in transatlantic slavery and related evils. And during that process, I came across this event. And for the next 5 years, I spent a lot of time studying and researching it because I had never heard of it, even though I grew up a one county removed from this event in southeast Arkansas. I eventually found out that my maternal grandfather, with whom I was very close, in fact, for the first few years of my life, he was my primary caretaker. And I found out that he had indeed participated in this terrible event. And I began to write pieces of it, about it, in various literary journals and that sort of thing. And also, being also a poet, I had written a series of poems about the event. And about, I would say, maybe 3 years ago, 3-4 years ago, I thought about putting an expanded version of my articles together with the cycle of poems together and see if there was interest in the book. As it turned out, an individual had been studying my own writings and came to me. He was a literary agent and he was British, but his wife was from Pine Bluff, Arkansas, which is also southeastern Arkansas. And he said, "You know, you've written about this event. You've written about civil rights. Civil rights and Black liberation have been important parts of your life. Why don't you take this moment in time and write about this event and in the context of your own views about racial reconciliation and Black liberation?" And I thought for a while, and it was with the onset of the white nationalism and unapologetic racism that has seeped in to every crevice of this country in the last several years. I felt it was appropriate to write this book in the context of my particular viewpoint.
Fantastic. Well, it's an amazing story, and you've thought a lot of deeply about racism, given, you know, from your religious faith and then from your personal history that you discovered. What do you think is the reason racism persists so badly in our country?
Well, that's an excellent question, Eleanor, because we look back and it just appears that there is something that it gears our culture toward racism. If you take, you know, the African Americans as being subjugated in this country goes back to 1619. And as I, over time, and I, you know, I have spent a lot of years looking at this problem and having my personal experiences with it and that sort of thing, because I grew up in a racist family in a racist region, having grown up in Southeast Arkansas in the Mississippi River Delta. And I've concluded that there are two major themes that drive this continuity of racism. One theme is what I have identified as damaged heritage, which is the title of this book, and it's this feature of American racism that consists of legacy and evidence passed on from generation to generation of ingrained prejudicial tradition and custom that's often codified in law. And that's combined with not infrequent, gratuitous, and often violence against African Americans are perpetrated by American whites against African Americans. And that is what I consider damaged heritage, and it has been with us. But I also have a feeling, or not a feeling, it's more than that. I really fundamentally believe that American whites, and especially the Southern whites, actually knew that they were doing wrong for generation after generation by bringing forward this damaged heritage and in the way in which they treated African Americans. But there was one thing that they couldn't overcome, and which gave them an excuse to live with this, you know, white supremacy and white rights, and that is, it's this excessive veneration for ancestors, for the past, for tradition. And a fancy name for it is called filial pietism. And a combination of those two things, this desire for white supremacy, for the economics and all the rest, combined with this filial pietism, have contributed to, well, they are the main forces that have driven white racism from generation to generation.
Yes, I think you've got some good insight there. You know, it strikes me too, along with this excessive veneration of ancestors and traditions, particularly in the South, there's a real ignorance about the real history. So, for example, I know a lot of Southerners will say the Confederate flag is a symbol of our pride in the South and our culture of the South and of states' rights. But what they leave off is it's a symbol of states' rights to have slavery. And the Confederate flag was actually the flag of an army that was raised treasonously against the United States. And I don't know of any other country that allows the flag of a treasonous army or puts statues up to the heroes of so-called heroes who are actually traitors to the country. And yet here we are in 2020 still having a debate about whether we should take down some of these southern monuments. So I think it's a combination of veneration of the past and a real misunderstanding of what the history is.
Yeah, I would.
Would you agree?
But it does, it's part and parcel of this issue of filial pietism, the real excessive veneration. And it serves as an excuse. It serves as a cover, which effectively inoculates, camouflages the real purpose of those views, and that is Black subjugation, mm-hmm. And the excuse for white supremacy, which I think any reasonable person stepping back to look at those motivations would certainly say, you know, this is something to, when you subjugate a different race of human being, by any measure, that is wrong. And it's been wrong from the very, you know, from the beginning. And I think most, even whites, realized it was wrong. But yet there was this terrific excuse that we could rely on our past to give us an ability to project this into, to force it into the future.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it's fascinating for me. I mean, your story is incredible. And we all now as a country are grappling with, how do we deal with race, mm-hmm. racism? How do we move beyond it? You talk about coming from a racist family in a racist region, and yet now you're an eloquent spokesperson for racial justice and equality. How did you move beyond your own racism?
Wow, that's a great question. And I don't have a definitive answer for you. I just don't. I can tell you a little bit about my history and how I arrived at where I am and where I was when I first realized how wrong we were in the South, to how wrong whites were to have taken not only the perspective, but this extraordinary act of supremacy over Blacks. I grew up in this small town in Southeast Arkansas, and I had Black friends when I was very young. There weren't many white people living close. I lived on sort of the other side of the tracks, and I became friends early on with a number of African Americans. But as we went to our separate schools, that friendship sort of mitigated, and finally we were just permanently apart. But for some reason, as I was growing up, I never felt that I was quite as white as a number of people did. And I don't know what that really means. I played Little League, and the bat that I always used was a bat with signature on it, was Larry Doby. And he was the American League equivalent of Jackie Robinson. He became a player for the Cleveland Indians. And I loved that bat. And that was my favorite bat. And I don't know whether it was an homage for my friendships with African Americans when I was growing up or not. But fast forward, I'm a junior. I'm going into my junior year at Harvard. And I'm studying that summer under a person who was not a normal professor at Harvard. And But that's the reason I was there. I wanted to study on him in that time. But I was preoccupied by reading about Freedom Summer. Mm-hmm. And that is when a large number of white students went to Mississippi to register voters, to change the mixture of social action so that whites and blacks mixed and spent a lot of time together, which was an affront to the existing social order, to open schools and to have a political exchange that was almost confrontational. And they focused on the northwest part of Mississippi, which is the Delta. And that's directly across the river, Mississippi River, from southeast Arkansas and from where I grew up and that sort of thing. And I couldn't really get my mind off of it. And by the time fall rolled around, I concluded that there was a racial revolution going on in the United States. And should I be stumbling around Cambridge, Massachusetts, or should I actually be in the South, trying to know as much as possible? And so I decided to go South and to really decide where I was on it, but also to understand it. I went down with all kinds of different questions. And for the next 3.5 years, I traveled a lot of the South. I had odd jobs. I wrote a lot. I was already writing at that point, particularly poems. And I wrote about it a lot. And it became my preoccupation. And during this period of time, I would, on occasion, take courses at the University of Arkansas. And I eventually got my degree from the University of Arkansas after this 3.5 to 4 year period that I spent in the South. I went to New York. I decided I needed a break, and I go to New York. Soon after that, Martin Luther King is assassinated. And by that time, I no longer had a lot of questions about Black liberation or racism. I had a congealed and pretty well codified view on what I believed. When King was assassinated, I felt I owed him something, that for a variety of reasons, the Black church, for example, I mean, I had sort of disassociated myself from the white church, and the Black church was very appealing to me and had a real significant effect on the Judeo-Christian approach of life, which really instilled itself in me. And anyway, I turned around, went back to the Mississippi River Delta, and I taught in an all-African-American public school, 6th through the 12th grades. And this was the... And this was a year before integration of the local education system, and that experience was also confirming. And by that time I had completely really rejected the any kind of semblance of the views that my family had on the issue of race and clearly the region as a whole. And I continue to write about it and mostly in poetry at the time, but also I've written a lot prose articles and that sort of thing. And then this book came along. And so the book really incorporates not only this event, this Elaine Race Massacre, but it also gave me an opportunity to talk about civil rights and my views on what can be done and what should be done and what we should aspire to. And I also had this other I had the event, and I'll just move right into this, if I may, is that during the time that I was evaluating the Elaine Race Massacre, a writer who had also been doing quite a bit of work and had written a book on the Elaine Race Massacre said, "Chester, I know an African-American woman whose ancestors were attacked, who were victims of the massacre. And she has been spending a lot of time on this event. Why don't we, I would suggest that the two of you meet."
And at this point, you didn't realize you had a personal connection?
Oh, I realized at that point.
Oh, you did. And that's why you were delving so deeply into it.
Right, exactly. Okay. By that time, I had realized that Lonnie Birch, my maternal grandfather, had participated in it. But Sheila and I got in touch with each other. Our first phone call lasted 2 hours. We decided that we would meet at her son's home in Boston, which we did. And it was just clear from the beginning that this was destined to be a racial reconciliation. Mm-hmm. And I'm answering your larger question of how did I end up being different, but in different views, but through this relationship with Sheila Walker, who actually wrote the foreword to the book, as we pursued this, it has a fancy name of racial reconciliation, but ultimately it was really abiding friendship, and our families got involved, our spouses got involved, and it just became a very meaningful relationship for both of us. In fact, one of my friends, after reading my book, said, "Yeah, Chester, I have a solution for this, for the country's racial problems. What we ought to have is, there are many people of goodwill here. What we need to do is have a Chester-Sheila relationship for all Americans and somehow bring them all together." Mm-hmm. But Sheila did something at the very beginning that was of the relationship that was very liberating, because I did worry as we were pursuing our friendship and this reconciliation that somehow Lonnie's role was a shadow over this relationship, or could be. I mean, how does someone like Sheila deal with me knowing that my maternal grandfather participated in it? And we were at a symposium where both of us spoke in September of 2014. And Sheila got up and said, "I forgive Chester's grandfather. I forgive Lonnie. I really believe that he was a compassionate, loving man. Otherwise, Chester wouldn't feel the way that he does toward Lonnie. But I realize we're born good. But bad situations can cause good people to do bad things. And the ability to forgive struck an important chord in me, because I've concluded that as a general matter, white folks don't deal very well with forgiveness, even when you receive forgiveness. King talked about it in terms of the weapon of love, or a weapon of love. And I think that's what he meant in terms of what Sheila did with respect to Lonnie. And a related issue is that, Dylan Roof, who committed those terrible murders at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, the relatives of those of the victims forgave him. And there was astonishment in the white community about this. I mean, how do we understand this? And I have learned a lot about forgiveness through my relationship with Sheila. In fact, she's been, you know, a guiding light in some ways with respect to my attempts to forgive. And I'm not sure I've really forgiven Lonnie because he ended up being a bifurcated person for me. He was that loving grandfather, but here he was a rifleman or a gunman who had participated in the massacre. And I just never had those merged together. And I'm certain I haven't truly forgiven him, but I'm working on it. Sheila's been enormously helpful in that whole pursuit.
Yeah, that's a very powerful story of that personal reconciliation. I'm going to loop back to that in a little bit, but I am sure most of our listeners like me have never heard of the Elaine Race Massacre. So I'd like for you to talk a little bit just like what actually happened back there, which you later found out your grandfather was part of it. But it's actually probably the largest incidence of violence of whites on blacks in the history of the country. And yet I never heard of it. And I'd like for you to share with our listeners kind of what exactly happened at the Elaine Race Massacre.
Okay. After World War I, black veterans came back to the United States, some of whom had been real heroes in the European theater during World War I. And they came back expecting that life would be better, that whites in this country would accept blacks in a way that they hadn't previously. When the blacks arrived on the shore back from Europe, whites rose up and all over this country and said, no, that's not going to happen. And there were racial conflicts that broke out all through this country, from Arizona to New England. So it wasn't just the South. But the Mississippi River Delta was probably one of the worst places. Now, as these veterans came back and started and took on their previous jobs of being sharecroppers, the price of cotton had risen to 50 cents a pound, which was really unheard of before the war. And the sharecroppers wanted to get a fair shake in with respect to the cotton that they brought in to the white planters, but they continued to get below market prices. And in Phillips County, Arkansas, where the massacre occurred, the sharecroppers had formed a union. It was actually a lodge of an existing union called Progressive Farmers and Household Union, Lodge of Hoop Spur. And Hoop Spur was just north of Elaine, Arkansas. And on the night of September the 30th, 1919, the deputy sheriff and a representative from the Missouri Pacific Railroad, and I might just step back for a minute. My grandfather worked his whole career was with the Missouri Pacific Railroad. He was an engineer there. And Missouri Pacific Railroad was up to its eyeballs in this massacre. As the story unfolds, it becomes pretty clear that's the case. Oh, and by the way, one other point is that this was the this occurred at the very end of what had been known as the Red Summer of 1919. It was named that by James Weldon Johnson, the African American poet, because of the number of conflicts that occurred between blacks and whites throughout the country. But back to my story, the deputy sheriff of Phillips County and the Missouri Pacific Railroad representative got out of their Model T and they fired gunshots into the church. Unbeknownst to them, the union had, this was the sort of the organizing meeting for this Hoopspur Lodge of the Progressive Farmers and Household Union. But unbeknownst to those two gentlemen, the union had hired guards to protect the process that evening. And those guards fired back at the two whites, and the Missouri Pacific Railroad representative was killed, and the deputy sheriff was shot in the knee. The deputy sheriff made it back to the county seat, told the sheriff about what had happened. So the sheriff deputized a large number of men to go back out to Hoopspur the following morning, and which they did, and they began to shoot African Americans, and between 15 and 20 African Americans were killed that first morning, but two additional whites were killed that morning. My own view is that they were probably killed by friendly fire, but it gave an excuse for the local leaders to press upon the governor of the state to say, there is an insurrection going on here in this, here in Phillips County. We need those federal troops that are located in Fort Pike, which is right outside of Little Rock. The governor in turn called the War Department, and this was during the Woodrow Wilson administration, which was known to be, or is known historically to be, quite racist. And the War Department immediately agreed to send those federal troops to Phillips County. Now, those troops had machine guns, and obviously they knew how to use them. And they came to Phillips County, and between 60 and 80 African Americans were killed, at least as attested to by studies that the FBI did almost immediately after the cessation of the attacks. But in addition to those, there were vigilantes who came over to Phillips County from Mississippi and from Tennessee, white men, to try to quell this so-called black insurrection, which it wasn't a black insurrection. And there's really no telling how many they killed. In fact, you know, there's evidence that they would be driving by a cotton field and just shoot African Americans, many of whom had never even heard of Hoopspur's or the violence of the night before or the several nights before at the Hoopspur Church. So that's an important part of the story, but there is a silver lining to this event. And if I may, I'd like to just quickly run through that. There was an African American lawyer in Little Rock. His name was Scipio Africanus Jones. Later on in his career, he actually worked with Thurgood Marshall with the NAACP in various lawsuits. But anyway, He represented the following this the violence. There were 74 African Americans found guilty. There were no whites who were charged with anything, but there were 74 African Americans who were convicted of first degree murder down to night riding, all these ranges of things. 12 were to be electrocuted within a very short period of time. The cases were egregiously unfair, including, I mean, juries were out as little as 2 minutes, and the lawyers selected came from political decisions as opposed to the sharecroppers being able to choose their own attorneys and that sort of thing. And the reason I'm raising that point is because it's important later in the story. But Scipio Africanus Jones ultimately wrote first of all, within 5 years after this, the prosecution and imprisonment of those 74, all 74 were free. And it's all a function of the work of brilliance and work of Scipio. He also wrote the brief that was submitted ultimately to the Supreme Court that would hear about 6 of those 12 blacks who were destined to be electrocuted at the Walls, which is a penitentiary outside of Little Rock. Scipio could not make the argument. There was a white attorney from Boston who made the argument to the Supreme Court. Audible Wendell Holmes wrote the opinion. And bear in mind, during this period of time, as I said, there had been these conflicts throughout the country of blacks and whites violently attacking each other. In fact, Rosewood happened only a week before the Supreme Court heard these cases and made a decision on these cases for the 6 African Americans who made an appeal to the Supreme Court under the 14th Amendment, 14th Amendment being equal justice under the law. Because after the 14th Amendment was approved in 1868, from 1868 until 1923, when the Supreme Court made this decision, the Supreme Court had decided repeatedly that individual states had the right to decide the civil rights of the individuals within those states. So the equal protection under the law just didn't apply. But in 1923, under a decision 6-2, the court case Moore versus Dempsey was decided on behalf of the sharecroppers. For the first time, a decision was made that the federal courts, when there's an egregiously unfair prosecution by states or local units within those states, and that can be proved, then the federal courts could intercede on behalf of those individuals. And that was the decision that came out. And that decision has really gotten a lot of attention recently, and quite frankly, without that decision, a lot of the civil rights movement probably would have been for naught. I mean, if you look at Brown versus the Board of Education, equal justice under the law is just sprinkled throughout that decision. And so that is the silver lining of all of this. I mean, it became a stepping stone. The Elaine Race Massacre and its aftermath, more particularly the decision of Moore versus Dempsey, proved to be an important stepping stone for the civil rights movement.
Yeah, so you could say in a way the civil rights movement began in 1923.
Yes, people have said that, by the way. I mean, there is a book now called Civil Rights and the Making of the Modern American State. And it says that, I mean, the book is all about Moore versus Dempsey and the Elaine Race Massacre. And it's published by Cambridge University Press, published in 2014.
So, and that is supposed to be the greatness of the United States, is that all countries have failings, but in the United States, we have the ability to grow and to learn and to change, that our system of government is such, like you talked about, even though at the local level, the white supremacists controlled the police and could take their guns and go shooting blacks in the fields, but we could appeal to the law, and that the law all the way to the Supreme Court with Oliver Wendell Holmes saying people have a right to call on the federal government for help when their civil rights are being violated. So that was the big doorway in that allowed for so many aspects of the civil rights movement where progress was made. So you're right, you know, it's a good silver lining. It's a stepping stone. It just somehow, yes, we celebrate the progress, but it's so depressing that we're still here 400 years later grappling with the original sin of slavery and having it blow up like it has over the past week, really more come to light. I mean, African Americans have known about this police brutality, but I didn't know it was still so pervasive myself, and I'm an avid newsreader. So we've come a long way, and we have a long way to go, that's for sure. And what was the role of your grandfather in the massacre? Do you know specifically what he did?
No, I don't know specifically. This is the story of how I came to understand his participation. He had worked for the Missouri Pacific Railroad, as I said, for his whole life, all of his working life. And he worked in the Southeast Arkansas hub for the railroad, which was in McGee, Arkansas, Deschutes County. Toward the end of his life, and by the way, Deschutes County is directly south of Phillips County. And his family, except for him, he didn't like farming. So he joined Missouri Pacific Railroad. But there were farms in the northern part of Deschutes County, just south of Phillips County. And the headquarters for the Progressive Farmers and Household Union was only like 5 miles from the Birch Farms, and all kinds of different other coincidences. But toward the end of his career, he was transferred to Little Rock, which was the main transportation center for a hub for in the state as a whole, while McGee was the hub for Southeast Arkansas. And they lived 3 blocks from Little Rock Central. By this time, I had already moved from being with my grandparents to living with my mother and my older brother. My older brother had gone off to college, and when Little Rock Central occurred, the crisis in Little Rock, when the 9 African-American students wanted to integrate the largest high school in the state, Little Rock Central High. As I said, it was 3 blocks my grandparents' home at that time. And my mother and I used to travel to Little Rock from Monticello, which is about 100 miles, on a regular basis to visit the grandparents. And we ended up having a lot of conversation about civil rights and Black liberation and that sort of thing. And during the course of that, those discussions, my mother talked about Lonnie and indicated that when she was young, not quite a teenager, that Lonnie had participated in this well-known race riot, and that a large number of African Americans had died. And she described the topography of the land in the way that Lonnie had described it to her and to the family. Described it in some detail. But I didn't really pay a lot of attention to it. I mean, you know, I was 13 years old, mm-hmm. and I remembered it, but I didn't pay a lot of attention to it. Then when I discovered the writings of Ida B. Wells and her piece on the Arkansas race riot of 1919, where she describes the Elaine massacre, I started to research what happened around that time in Southeast Arkansas in terms of what race riots, what massacres occurred. And there were many lynchings within that period of time right after World War I, or even burnings of African Americans alive. But they were one or two persons. There was only one massacre. There was only one race, so-called race riot, but it was in fact a massacre, where so many people were killed. And also the topography that my mother had told me was very consistent with what happened in Elaine. And with Elaine being the only, meaning only massacre in that period of time, it was the, and it was so geographically close to Lonnie's, the farms, the home, at least in the Shea County, which was one county south, just one, it was a southern part of south of Phillips County. It was just, that was, and also the Missouri Pacific Railroad, because the first death in the massacre was this white person who was from Missouri Pacific Railroad, and they used to send train cars of various people from Missouri Pacific Railroad into the killing fields during that week where the deaths were occurring. I mean, as I said, Missouri Pacific Railroad was up to its eyeballs in it, and and so that was, I tied the, I came to the conclusion that the Elaine race massacre that I learned about from Ida B. Wells and the well-known race riot that my mother told me about and that Lonnie had described to the family were one and the same.
Right. I'd like to circle back now. We just have a few minutes left, but to this relationship you've had with the other descendant from that Sheila. And you talked about how Sheila was able to forgive your grandfather, Lonnie, but you haven't been able to find that place in yourself to right. forgive him yet. And it's fascinating to me because Sheila's the descendant of a victim of that racial violence, and you're a descendant of the perpetrator. Why do you think she has been able to forgive him, and what do you think it will take for you to be able to forgive him?
The latter, I'm not quite sure. I'm working on it, and I know that that's what I would eventually like to do. But it's not as though I am set on resisting this forgiveness. It's just a matter that it is just hard for me to see why someone, he was a member of the KKK, he was. Mm-hmm. He used to put his sheet and hood on and go out and come back and several hours later, never tell anyone what had happened. But the idea of participating in this terrible event and being part of it it's an affront to my personal conscience, and it's very hard. And when we started talking about this, I mentioned that, you know, it was it's this inability for me to join or coalesce the two Lonnies in such a way that that I can forgive the entirety of this person's being. And also I can't deny that I believe that I think that whites knew that it was wrong the way they were subjugating blacks, and yet it continued and continued, and I can't necessarily let this. I have to deal with it. I didn't participate in the massacre. I don't necessarily feel white guilt about it. On the other hand, it's part of my damaged heritage, and I have to deal with it, or I forced it for the future. I forced it on the future, and I am set on dealing with this. I mean, I have been spending years now dealing with this event and Lonnie's participation in it. I still adored him. I still adore him effectively, he rescued me at a time when I was 1 year, you know, my father died when I was one, and I lived with, he was my 24-hour-a-day caretaker for years, until I started a school. So there is, I still care deeply for him. I just haven't gotten to that point where I can consciously and thoroughly say what Sheila says about him, and that is, he's a deeply compassionate and loving man. I understand. I mean, I certainly experienced it, but I'm not quite there. And Sheila and I've had many discussions about it, and I'm very hopeful that I'll get there soon. But as I said during the course of this conversation, I find that whites, and I'm obviously white, have trouble with forgiveness, and that is the acceptance of forgiveness. Forgiveness is not something that is that we seem to feel comfortable with.
And still, you've done a great job in terms of this personal connection with Sheila and the personal racial healing that has happened through that connection.
Right.
And how do you think other people can use the work you've done in terms of that relationship with Sheila to maybe use that as a model for how reconciliation might happen around race in our country?
That's an excellent question. And I'd like to start with invoking a line from a philosopher named Soren Kierkegaard, who 170 years ago said that we do not learn anything that is genuinely human from a past generation. That is, that if we want to be genuinely human in the way in which we react to others, it is up to us. And I find that the relationship that I have with Sheila, it manifests itself in our ability to say that there is a commonality between us, but not just to us. There is a commonality in black and white that exceeds these sort of marginal facets, the color of our skin, the accents, our customs, our history, our traditions. Those are marginal in comparison with the commonality that exists between two people, regardless of the color of their skin. And I define that as the genuinely human. And I think that that's where what we've tried to do in our racial reconciliation can be or used as an example for people, black and white, accepting that commonality and discounting the marginal issues of color of skin, accents, vocabulary, whatever, that are marginal. And I think that's what we have we've done. Unfortunately, I find that a lot of people who want to get involved in race issues have an inclination to try to do them through institutions, and they do it in a good spirit of institutions, but I believe, based on the experience that Sheila and I have had and how that has expanded into our families as well, is a good precedent for one-on-one of people of goodwill breaking away from the institutional protection and reaching out to each other in loving ways. This is going to take love involved. I mean, you've got to, I think the race issue is resolved mainly through one-to-one relationships,
right?
Not theoretical.
That's a great statement, and our time is up, so we're going to need to end it there. Listeners, the book is called Damaged Heritage, The Elaine Race Massacre, and A Story of Reconciliation. That's all the time we have. Chester Johnson, thank you so much for being with us on All Together Now.
Well, I've been honored to be here, and thank you very much. Hope you have me back someday.
Look forward to that time. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.